So that, of course, took some time. I don't know how many hours with him, with Bartel, to get his story, but it took a lot of visits to his house. And I wanted to talk to people who had played with and against him. So, and this was in the 70s before I even thought about Connie Mack. So that meant some travel, because they're all over the place. So I did, and I talked to a bunch of guys, and I list them in the front of the book about the Giants and about Bartel and about the other teams that he was with during his career. And so all of that was done before I could actually sit down and write it. And by that time, I had moved to Connecticut. So when the book actually came out, I was in Connecticut. And Bartel came to see me there, and we made the rounds, and I took him to a couple of Sabre meetings, and he had the book with him. And we went to some newspapers, and he went down to Philadelphia because he had played in Philadelphia before the Giants, where he threw out the first ball before a Phillies game. There's no more Giants to take him to. Or Brooklyn, which we would have loved, because they hated him in Brooklyn. And that would have been great to take him there. So, and he used to go around at his home in Alameda. He played a lot of golf. And he went around and he had kept books in his trunk of his car. And he would sell them out of the trunk of his car. He was very proud of having written a book. And a lot of his teammates were amazed because they never connected him with writing anything, much less a book. They just didn't connect him with even reading books. And so he had a ball. He just loved the whole experience.
And Rex Barney, how did you connect with him?
I wound up in Baltimore, where Rex Barney was the PA announcer and had been for years. And I met him, he was at the old Baltimore Stadium. And we talked, because I remembered him, and because this is now the 90s. Not many people remember it. The press box is full of guys young enough to be his grandkids. And I can relate to him and his time. So I was doing some interviewing because I was writing, I had a press pass from the Orioles Gazette, the Orioles newspaper they used to put out. And so I would contribute to that. Mm-hmm. So I had this press pass. So, and this is the old Memorial Stadium. So I would go down to where Rex was sitting as the PA and would sit on a box next to him. It was far from the plushness of the new stadium. And we would talk, and he enjoyed it because he would mention players from his time, and I knew who he was talking about. He would mention guys he had pitched against, and the conditions of the game, and the front office, and whatever it was, I knew what he was talking about, could relate to it, could answer it, or could fill in somebody he was trying to think of that nobody else in the press box could do. So he loved that. Mm-hmm. So we became friends. Mm-hmm. And one day, I don't remember, I think we had moved to a new stadium, but I'm not sure of that. He had been to some Sabre meetings that were held at the old ballpark. He would go. He enjoyed it. And he would tell stories. So he knew Sabre. Mm-hmm. And I heard some of his stories. And I told him, you should write a book. And now he wasn't interested. So I kept after him, and he would tell more of these stories, and then I got him to tell me a little bit about his experience during the war. He was a tank driver in a reconnaissance group, and they would be the head of the line, of the U.S. Army line. And he was in the tactical command working for Patton. Mm-hmm. And their job was to go and to find the enemy. Mm-hmm. How close are we to the enemy? Mm-hmm. This is his job. And I kept asking him questions because I'm interested. And I kept telling him, let's write a book. So this went on a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And finally I sat him down. He had diabetes. He had one leg amputated at the knee as a result of it. And I would visit him, and he was broadcasting during the off-season. He had a program, a radio program. And I sat him down once in the ballpark and I said, you know something? You're going to die one day. He agreed. And I said, all these wonderful stories that I've heard you tell at Sabre, and I've heard you tell me in the press box, and whenever we're together, they're going to die with you. And these kids, and he loved the kids, he talked to the kids on the radio, and they loved him because he treated them well, he treated them like equals, he never talked down to them, and he would tell them, now mind your mother, say thank you and please. Do your homework. He would talk to them. And he would answer. They would call in. And a lot of kids would call in to ask him questions. He had a call-in show. And they said, all these kids who love you, they're never going to read your stories because you're going to be gone. Mm-hmm. When they grow up and they're going to read, they're never going to know you. And I don't know if it was right then or shortly after, he said, "You convinced me." So we began, and this took a lot of time, to meet. And he was living at that time at a kind of residential hotel. And he was eating there a lot. So we would meet there during the off season for the day and sit in a meeting room there, talking, going over everything. And I would look up things in the meantime to ask him about, telling me his whole life and answering my questions. And then we'd break for lunch and we'd go and eat lunch there. Then we'd go back in the afternoon, talk some more. And during the season, we would meet in the morning. And he came to my house and stayed there a couple of days. And we talked. And I was not living right in Baltimore. And I've got to transcribe all this, because this is all in the '70s. This is all in 80. What years was I there? 89. When did the book come out? 89 to 94, I'm going to say.
Okay.
Because I then went around talking to guys he had played with.
Mm-hmm.
During the same stretch.
Okay, the same stretch. So you interview the player first, then talk to the people who observed him or were teammates, and then you had a full sort of a holistic view.
I know sitting in the SMU library is all of the Rex Barney tapes, and they're 90 minutes each, and there's I think somewhere between 10 and 15 of them.
Hmm.
So that's how many hours, and that's not counting the players I talked to.
Yeah. So 15 to 20 hours of tapes or so.
At least. Yeah. Maybe more. So they're there. So I had to transcribe all these, talk to all these other guys, and then the book came out. And it is not 600 page book. It's a normal 300 something page book. Mm-hmm. Because his playing career was relatively short.
Mm.
And of course he was a manager for all those years and everything. But I consider the Rex Barney book, not just from a research standpoint, but as a story, the best that I've done.
Hmm.
Because it is the story of a man who was a failure, yet could well have been a Hall of Famer, and he knew it. He knew it all his life.
Mm-hmm.
And he made the rest of his life. He knew it to the extent that he tried to kill himself, or certainly thought about it. Yet he made a success of his life as a radio and a game broadcaster and the PA announcer for, 32 years or something like that in Baltimore, and made himself beloved in Baltimore. So, to me, it's the best story. And he was a good teller of it, a good talker of it, and enthusiastic about it, and left nothing out.
What was the impetus for your creation of Sabre's Oral History Committee? Was it one particular interview? Was it an abstract idea that we have to preserve these stories?
It was, yes, we have to preserve these, combined with, if you do this, and I wasn't the only one doing them. Mm-hmm. There were other guys who were doing them at the same time. That I didn't know. Mm-hmm. Was it, yes, these should be collected by all of us doing them. There should be a place in Sabre that should have them, that all these guys are doing them. And two, as far as I was concerned, this was the most fun that any Sabre committee activity could be, of the list of committees that existed at that time.
There have been things like baseball records or things like that that wouldn't be nearly as interactive. Or
that of all of them, this would be for people the most fun to be part of, to go and get and do the interviews for the committee. So it was those two things, they were the basis for starting it.
And what did you envision would happen to the what were then tapes? Did you think they would be best saved at the Hall of Fame? Or?
Well, it reached a point where our Cleveland office didn't have any room for them. So we said to the Hall of Fame, will you keep these for us? Will you make them available for people to hear them at the Hall of Fame and keep them cataloged? So we knew what was there. We knew who had made them. And people could go there and listen to them. And they agreed. Because I don't know if you ever saw the office in Cleveland.
I did see the office in Cleveland.
Or the original office in Cleveland.
Not the original one, the later one.
Okay. The later one, really, wasn't much bigger.
Yep.
And so we didn't have the room. Just like our records all went to the Cleveland Library. So that's how they wound up in the Hall of Fame. And it took a long time eventually when we went to Arizona to get the Hall of Fame to give them back. That was a struggle. And to make copies and give them back. And so it was largely because we didn't have the room in Cleveland that I was keeping mine at home. And then they went because SMU said also that they would digitize them. I knew there were some of them that were not good quality. They were old. They were taped over things, and my equipment wasn't the greatest back then. So I knew they were not good quality and were deteriorating and would continue to deteriorate if I sent them to Arizona. So we weren't even in Arizona at the time.
No, that wasn't until 10 years ago, give or take.
Has it been 10 years?
I don't think it's been quite 10 years. Probably less than that. I want to say 2009.
Of course, it was. Mine was. Yeah, it was after that that I had to get rid of. So, but SMU said we have the space, we have the facilities, and we have the people to catalog stuff, and eventually, although it would take some time, to get them digitized and copied and everything. So that sounded like the right place.
What would you like to see the Oral History Committee be doing now? What sort of work do you think most needs to be done in the realm of oral history, should it be?
It should be the players and managers are certainly the, I mean, there's a whole new generation of them. And it should be added to. And the equipment is so much better now. Certainly it's got to be added to. Because all of ours, I mean, are old guys. They're not even the guys who played in the 60s and 70s and 80s.
That's right, there are very few in our collection.
Yeah. So while they're still around, sure they should.
Do you feel there's much merit in doing oral history with contemporary players? I mean, the games are all part of, I think, the value of oral history with the older players is to explain what things happen on the field we may not be able to see through videotape, but now everything's videotaped. Does that diminish the value?
No, it doesn't diminish a Randy Jones talking about playing for Dick Williams.
Yeah.
Or being in a bullpen with a Goose Gossage, or who do they remember on any team they played with or against who approaches the game? What pitchers approach the game like Max Scherzer today,
okay,
or like a Nolan Ryan or a Roger Clemens? Who were the guys? I mean, these are things I would ask. Who were the guys in their time, which after all, the 70s is still 40 years ago.
Yep.
It's a long time.
It is a long time.
And we're not getting those guys. And even the 80s, okay. So it's 30 years ago. We're not getting those guys. But their careers are over. And they can compare players from their time to now, which to me is a valuable part of an interview. And they can talk about playing for managers of that time that the older players didn't. The La Russas and Alston. And, well, you name it. I mean, so certainly a lot of the questions to me would be the same. What was it like to play for this guy? What was it like to pitch or bat against these guys? Or I would ask every pitcher, can you remember the best pitch you ever threw? Because I found that 30, 40 years later, these guys have got all these things in their heads.
Yes, often to very minute detail.
Or I would ask on that Joe Adcock, can you still visualize and can you tell me the four pitches you pitch for home runs on this day that you hit four home runs. And he could tell me who they were against, where they went, this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So those are timeless questions. I would ask guys, I asked Ted Lyons, how did you pitch against Babe Ruth? Mm-hmm. What was your strategy? How did you, I asked Carmen Mill, how did you pitch against Babe Ruth in the 1927 World Series when he hit a home run against you? And they know. They can tell you. And that those are timeless questions. You could ask Randy Jones questions like that.
Sabre seems right now to have two distinct camps, the analytics camp and the history camp. Do you worry sometimes that the history side is being lost relative to the analytics side?
I don't worry about it, but I know it's shrinking in proportion.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think young guys joining today are joining for that.
Yeah. And why do you think that is? Why do you think the history has... Is it just the appeal of analytics that's crowding out the history, or is something in the way that baseball is reported today make it so that we just don't pay attention to
it? I think it's Sabre's fault. Hmm. Sabre is stressing the analytical. Uh-huh. Sabre has its own analytical conference.
Right.
Sabre doesn't have a Let's Listen to Old-Timers conference.
And that may be because of a desire to attract younger members and therefore feeling that, well, it's
self-fulfilling. Not only that, and to relate and get in on more and sell Sabre more to current player management, team managements and team ownership.
Uh-huh.
To be more of the modern game and the modern television aspect of the game and the modern blogs about the game. Blogs don't talk about old-timers. There is no blog of just snips of interviews with old-timers.
Mm-hmm.
And Sabre isn't trying to do it.
Yeah.
And they could. They could have their own Sabre old-timers blog where the whole world can listen to snips from their own collection.
Yeah. Do you feel that there's a... There are people who say that...
And, to finish that point, your own site on Sabre, listening to the tapes, is open only to members.
It shouldn't be. It should be open to everyone now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is open to everyone now, as far as I know.
Is it?
Yeah.
I thought it was members only.
There shouldn't be any login required.
I thought it was members only.
No, it shouldn't be.
Check it out.
I'm not aware of it.
Check it out.
I'll pull a look on my own phone, and I will tell you, I do not believe there's been no restriction on it to my knowledge. And it's, I'm just going to type in without logging
well,
in.
It may be, I may have it wrong.
But we had a bit of a debate about this, because for a while the Sabre newsletters were all tied. For instance, here's an interview of Mel Harder. And I have not logged in, nor have I ever attempted to log in. I can just click on the audio, and it will start to play.
Okay. Okay.
And so...
So, but does the world know it?
It may need to know it better than it does.
Okay.
I think that this site...
And that's my point. Yeah. The Sabre emphasizes completely the
Analytics. Yeah.
Sabre itself never publicizes, promotes the history part.
Right. And that's, we're going to lose members if that continues.
And you have to go to Sabre to find it.
Right.
So the whole world doesn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Yet Sabre could put up its own oral history site that has nothing to do with membership, nothing to do with the organization itself, except that it's Sabre that's putting this up. And anybody in the world could go to it, or if it was a blog, could listen to it as a blog. And I have no idea how the blog world works, mm-hmm. or how people find out there is such and such a blog, mm-hmm. but certainly Sabre could do it, mm-hmm. and they don't.
You mentioned the bloggers a couple of times. It doesn't seem as though there are a lot of people doing the kind of work that you did today. At least, they're certainly not on the internet, and that we need a younger crowd to come and be sort of historically minded when it comes to baseball. What stories do you think, are there particular players, are there particular incidents that you say to yourself, much like Connie Mack, needs to be reported?
I would go to the biographical committee, mm-hmm. and I would find, and I tried this many years ago, I would find the oldest living players down to the age of 80. And I would make an effort of finding Sabre members who live in or near those same, where these people are, or find out where they are, find Sabre members near them, do anything I could to send them a standard set of questions based on the teams they play for, and get after those Sabre members to go tape interviews with those guys who live near them while you still can, uh-huh. for the oral history committee. Uh-huh. That's what I would do. First priority.
I also, in terms
doesn't,
of...
Doesn't matter who they are, who they played for.
Whether they played one game or not.
When they played, right. Uh-huh. Get the oldest.
There are some gaps in the literature, too. Like, for instance, Frank Chance has never had a biography written about him that I'm aware of. Do you think there's still a role for going back and writing biographies, maybe not of people of major stature, but of minor stature?
This is for publishers to decide more than me. I would say, yeah, the more the merrier. In line with that, Nebraska has become the largest in the world, mm-hmm. for baseball books. Mm-hmm. I would think they would do it. Chance book. I've heard that to them a bestseller is 3,000 copies. Uh-huh. So they don't look for blockbuster sales. Uh-huh. So they're more willing to do it. And they're more willing to do it because they control their print runs. Uh-huh. But I would certainly say yes. I mean, Frank Chance is a Hall of Famer. Uh-huh. Along a similar line, we were just talking about the set of Putnam books. I don't know if you've ever seen them. It came out in the 30s and 40s. Yeah. Team histories.
Yep.
Written, they were all about the same size. All written by beat writers, uh-huh. who knew the teams. It's been an old time, been there a long time. Knew the team, knew the managements. They were written without stats. They were written breezily, conversationally, not academically. And they were great. as to a kid growing up. And we were talking because Nebraska does not do reprints anymore. We were talking about doing a set of those only of the post-expansion teams. Mm-hmm. Only of the post-original 16 teams. Mm-hmm. Which haven't been done.
Yeah, you're right, they haven't.
And they're open to that.
That's a wonderful idea that I might not have thought of. In other sports, in football, we pay almost no attention to the names of the 30s. We never hear about them.
That's another thing I talked about. And another thing I would have done if I could. I did the first and only one. And it's called Sunday. I did it with another guy because I had to. Because I didn't know the players, and I did it with a guy who was there at the time, who was broadcasting the games, who knew all the players, who could introduce it, and we split them. I did half the interviews, he did half, but he could introduce me to guys who knew him. Uh-huh. And we did it. And granted, any book is likely to be a regional book, but we did the Colts, the Baltimore Colts, the original Colts of the 50s. And we called it Sundays at 2, because that's when the games were. Sundays at 2 with the Baltimore Colts, and they have now officially sold out. We did it as a paperback, and you can find it on Amazon now for sale, a few of them, at $50 and $60.
And this was published in 1995.
And we aimed only at the Colts market.
Yeah.
That's all.
But those markets are very powerful. They love their team.
And the first one I would do now, Green Bay Packers.
Okay.
It's a natural.
Natural and a...
And I tried to find a guy, a writer, who had been around in the days of the Brett Files and Paul Hornings and the and the older guys. Never connected with it. A couple guys who were still covering the Packers. One said he didn't have the time. Another wasn't interested.
This was done by Tidewater Publishers.
Yeah. They sold out, and the current publisher still had a few, and the guy who bought out Tidewater, which was a local Maryland publisher. And I would find the local publisher, although somebody at the convention mentioned to me Arcadia.
Yes.
Arcadia does, I don't know where they're based, but they do regional books. Mm-hmm. So they would be in tune with the concept. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to contact them because I'm looking for somebody to do a reprint. Mm-hmm. And Nebraska said we would do it, except the policy now is we don't do reprints anymore. Because they have too many new things to deal with. So, I want to do a reprint of it, and I think it's a great idea for all of the NFL markets.
Mm-hmm. That would be a fantastic idea, and I would be, as a Cleveland Browns fan growing up, that would be the sort of thing that I would purchase. What I was getting at with my earlier point was that, especially with football, they don't really look to the past much. I mean, it's really the last few years, basketball too.
Basketball, completely. I mean, it's such a different game.
Yeah, such a different game. You can't compare the 50s to now or anything like that, but you can compare it in baseball. Why do you think that the history of baseball remains relevant today?
I would question whether it does, number one, if you say relevant to today's under 40s,
mm-hmm.
I don't know that it does.
You could argue that it should, if well, only to examine the certain patterns. Let's say when scoring was down in 2011, it mirrored the way scoring was in 1911. And there are baseball lends itself to these kinds of comparisons. If you don't look at the history, you lose some of the flavor.
How much interest is there in the history of the United States anymore?
I think there's interest in the history of the U.S. presidency, in other words, sections of U.S. history, but not as much as there used to be. Maybe because we're so saturated with new news that we don't pay attention to the old
maybe
news.
Maybe because there is more old history now than there used to be.
Yeah, that's true. But at the same time, I mean, you said, let's say about Connie Mack, that it was a never-ending, fascinating story. And in some ways, the story...
To me.
Yes, to you. But in some ways, the story of baseball parallels the growth of the country at that time, too. And it's in some ways a never-ending, fascinating story that, to me, would fascinate people now just as much as it did then.
If it did, it would be in a much shorter version.
Yes.
Granted, I agree that these three volumes are daunting to a reader, even one who is interested in it.
Yes.
And guys kept coming up to me who proudly said, "I have now finished all three volumes." And I would tell them, "You are a member of the most exclusive club in Sabre." Because I suspect it's true. That is daunting, no question about it. But even I think the history of World War II is fading because the younger generations will no longer have had a parent or grandparent who was in it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be way back in the tree in not too long a time.
Mm-hmm. I guess to me, part of the fascination of early century baseball comes from the detective work. We don't know what happened in a lot of these cases. You're piecing things together from fragments, which I find personally to be fun. The ballplayers, I think, had much more personality. You know,
definitely.
I think John Thorne, under one photo, said the ballplayers had faces then, in a way that they don't today. There's a certain distinctiveness, individuality.
And they had stories, they had various origins. Today's players have very similar childhoods.
Yeah. Very you don't have different body types. You don't have different looks. Even the stories of coming up from the coal mines to the major leagues isn't something of today.
That's right. And the whole minor league experience isn't.
That's right.
Doesn't exist anymore.
Doesn't have the camaraderie that you had and the...
Or the variety.
Yeah.
I mean, where did these... I don't know how many minor league teams there are anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Or how many leagues. There aren't many.
Yeah.
So...
And to me, part of the richness of, let's say, the glory of their times is partially that it is a book about, you know, a time. And you learn about the time as much as you do about baseball. And
well, that's true of mine.
Yeah.
A lot of these childhoods were in the 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. And that's all gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have talked for a very long time. I did want to ask you what your now that you've had the Chadwick Award presentation, said you described your life as a life in baseball. And in your life in baseball, what memories are the strongest for you?
The Garrett Ripken connection that I mentioned. In modern times, seeing the Orioles beat Randy Johnson twice in one playoff.
Yes.
Which is, yeah, I mean, that was... And they couldn't beat Andy Pettit to save their lives, but to do that in one was great. But the old days, to have had a chance, which I did, to meet Van Lingle Mungo when I was a kid, and a guy who was a friend of our families and who sold a lot of the players' cars in the 30s, brought Van Lingle Mungo and Harry Danning and Hank Lieber out to our house and get to meet those guys, for a kid was great. To be able, after a Yankees game, to exit the ballpark on the field, through the outfield, by the monuments that were in the outfield. And they had a big thing that opened up out to the street beyond that for people to get out of the ballpark. Mm-hmm. And just to walk across, and to have seen Joe DiMaggio. Nobody ever played the outfield like Joe DiMaggio. Mm-hmm. Nobody could cover ground, get a jump on the ball, maneuver through those monuments to make catches. Mm-hmm. Or stand at the plate with such stature. Mm-hmm. Classic, motionless, no gyrations, no foot stuff, no gloves or stuff, no stepping out. Just standing there, eyeing the pitcher. That was an experience. I saw Babe Ruth bat once in an exhibition game as an old man during the war. That's the only time I ever saw him actually bat. He would come in the Yankee Stadium for games, and he would always sit behind the dugout, and he always wore the same cap and camel's hair coat. And he would always get applause from all over the ballpark when people saw him and caught on that he was there. He wasn't at every game, but I've seen him there.
Mm-hmm. So you've seen Ruth, and you've seen Gary, and you've seen, presumably, Paige and Dobie.
Yeah, you mentioned Paige, but I thought first of the other Paige. I was there in 1947 in a night game. I think Bucky Harris was the manager. When the biggest crowd ever was there. And it was 74, it was an odd number, 74,747. And it was 1947. And the place was so jammed, I was sitting on the steps next to the seats. And it was the game that they brought in Joe Paige in the middle of the game, not the end, but the middle of the game, in relief, and I think it was his first game, and if not, it was a game that made him, and I think maybe the bases were loaded, I'd have to look it up. And he got that side out, and he pitched the rest of the game because relievers in those days finished. Not just Page, but other relievers also would pitch multiple innings to finish the game. And that game is memorable.
Hmm. Well, we have...
And it was the start of... They didn't win it in 46 and they didn't win it in 48, but the 49, 50, 51, 52 run, they won them. They won the pennants.
Have you always been an Orioles fan?
For no, long? I was an Orioles fan while I lived in Baltimore.
Okay. Obviously, there's an Orioles logo right here.
Yeah, I got that while I was there.
At our feet. But I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
Well, I want to thank you. I enjoyed it. And
so we are good to go. Thank you so much, Norman Mocht.
Can I take you?